All of the government programs that we don't like are funded by theft. All of the government programs that we do like... Oh, sorry, there aren't any. Government is the reason that healthcare is expensive. Government is the reason you can't go to college. Taxation is theft.
And welcome back to Taxation is Theft, the show that talks about all the ways the government is ripping you off, broadcasting live on Facebook and YouTube from an underground bunker somewhere in the jungle of Mexico. I'm Dan Taxation is Theft Berman, former presidential candidate with the Libertarian Party, or something like that, currently in the race for governor of Texas. And today I have an awesome guy joining me, John Gordon, who's running for common counsel in Plattsburgh, New York, in Ward 5. We stumbled into each other. It's a really interesting story. We stumbled into each other over some Twitter posts, and I was really intrigued by the stuff that he was posting. So we started a conversation, and we'll tell you all about that. It's actually pretty awesome. It's especially interesting because you would think that there's some sort of rivalry here just because of political ideologies. That's how people normally are. But we're probably going to show you today how you can actually like have conversations with people you don't agree with on everything, and things are actually okay. The world's not going to end. But before we get started, of course, I want to ask you for your support. Head on over to taxationistheft.cards and help us with some of our amazing projects. We are spreading this information all around the world. We've got support from all of the 6 relevant continents, not the one that has nobody on it. Anything you buy from our store goes to help keep this show on air and to help us distribute all the counter propaganda that we're distributing all around the world and the United States. So please help us out with that. But now on to the show. John, welcome. How's it going?
Hey, good. It's good to talk to you.
Awesome. Yeah. So, let's kind of give everybody the background. So the first thing that caught my attention was this tweet that you made, and I should have pulled it up. It was something to the effect of if the only way to, like, if we live in a society that's based on you have to comply with the police or your life is at stake, then we're basically living under tyranny or oppression.
Yeah, yeah. If there's an armed group that can demand your obedience at the threat of death or a gun, that's not a sign of a free society. So that was what the tweet was for sure. And I want to give credit where credit is due for that. Robert Evans is a journalist that I follow. He's on I Write OK on Twitter. And he has this podcast that he runs called Worst Year Ever, among others. And that's actually paraphrased almost directly from him.
Awesome. And it's an interesting sentiment because I, of course, always draw the relationship between that and taxes, right? If you don't pay the taxes, they're going to come raid your house and take you off to jail. Yeah. It's really the same sort of thing. But of course, I'm also very critical of the police and the way that they do that, because in a very broad sense, you could consider a tax not just money, but a tax on your freedom and liberty. Restricting your livelihood, preventing you from being able to defend yourself, preventing you from being able to take care of your family, those sorts of things. So I think it's, but it was really interesting. And I have to say, like, one of the things that I first saw was when you tweeted it, because I made this mistake before. Elon Musk tweeted something about, like, the red rose on Twitter, right?
Yeah.
And so I replied to that, and then somebody else called me an idiot because, like, I had no idea what the red rose was. I thought he just, like, put it there to be flowery. And somebody told me it had to do with communism. And then I saw it next to you, and I was like, this doesn't sound like something a communist would say, I don't think.
Yeah.
So we had a conversation about that. So let's go there. Like, what's your take on what this red rose means?
I got a chuckle about someone saying that it's communism, because in my experience, if you ask 10 people what communism is, you're going to get 10 different answers.
Right.
Nobody really can tell you what it is. It's just kind of a pejorative term, like, oh, you're a communist. But I mean, you, let me back up here.
You had a poem that you,
Oh, yes. Yeah, I am a scatterbrained individual, by the way. It's just fundamentally who I am. So, yes, the poem, it's called Bread and Roses, and it's related to the Bread and Roses strike. And that is sort of where it speaks to me, and it's kind of like one line in the poem is, no more the drudge and idler tend that toil while run reposes. Like, basically, you know, there shouldn't be one person who's just resting and getting fat off everything while everybody else is working hard to make that happen. You know, and I think in a lot of ways, we have a lot of entities in our world that exist in that way, that kind of have that hierarchical relationship with us and impose their will upon us. You know, and I think that's sort of fundamentally those power relationships is a lot of where I come to libertarianism, is sort of flattening those hierarchies and finding ways to make them less significant, to allow people to come together as equals and manage their own lives and also manage their collective matters in a fair and equitable way.
Right. And so, and it's interesting because, I mean, a lot of the things you're saying right now, I think most libertarians would completely agree with, but for some reason, there's like this divide among libertarians. A lot of them will say, you know, especially a lot of the ones who, I guess they'd be called bottom right, or, you know, the capitalist leaning, whether they're ANCAPs or LibCaps, or I guess you would call them. Between that and libertarian socialism is like, a lot of people are just like, oh, that, no, but that's socialism and we want nothing to do with that. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, but at the same time, like a lot of the things that you're saying are, you know, there's not really anything offensive in there, to that. So, and I want to point that out because we, and, you know, that's not to say that we agree on everything, but, to some degree, we agree on a lot, and working together on what we do agree on can really stop the tyranny that is the state that is imposing all of these unjust laws on us that are forcing us to live a certain way. But let me ask you, to you, what's the difference between libertarian socialism and any other form of libertarianism?
I think that it comes, like, I think the key word to add in there is solidarity, like sort of the fundamental libertarian is sort of that liberty, equality, you know, being, having the liberty to live your life the way you want to. But then I think that with that comes a certain responsibility to other people to allow them to live their lives the way they want to. And I think that the best approach, the most fair approach to parsing out those interactions and where people's rights clash against each other is an approach of solidarity where two people come together, hey, we both want to benefit from the situation. How can we make that happen? And I think that in practice, the way we have things currently set up, it doesn't really work out that way. I mean, most of us work for an employer who imposes their will upon us as an employee. And I mean, if you start bringing that up and someone may tell you, well, why don't you start your own business? But the average person in the United States has less than $1,000 in savings, makes probably $30,000 a year. So one way to circumvent that may be to form a cooperative. So let's say, what does it take? Like $30,000 to start a business? Just to like get a location, get some materials, sure, tools, et cetera. I don't know what the exact number is, but for the sake of
argument. Well, it's going to vary depending on the business and everything.
But. Yeah. So let's say the average person has around $1,000 in savings. So we get 30 people together. It is not realistic for a startup business on day one to be able to sustain 30 people. Because it takes time to build the customer base. It takes time to hammer out all of the roadblocks and hurdles. Eventually businesses can sustain 30 people, but not from day one. And there's not really a lot of support for cooperatives. You know, there's a lot of support for private traditional businesses where an employer can get a loan to rent out a space and to buy these stuff, but there's not a lot of support for a group of people to do so. And I think that that is a gap that needs to be filled somehow, is allowing a group of people to come together and start a business and go to work as a group of equals rather than an employer who brings employees to impose their will upon.
So what's interesting, I mean, like, because what you're talking about is still, you totally hit the nail on the head before when you said, you know, if you ask 10 people what communism is, they'll all have a different thing. And I think that's that's more true for words that are more complicated to fill, like any of the isms, capitalism, communism, because those are complex words. It's not like, bottle, like this is a bottle. Like,
yes. That it's very easy. Yeah.
And but you'll still have like some people who will say like, oh, no, that's not a bottle. That's a jug or that's a can. Right. And so people will on simple words, but the more complex they are, the more variance you have with that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's important. But like what you're talking about, I think a lot of people would still say, but that's capitalism. You're talking about starting a business.
Yeah.
You're talking about a different way of cooperatively bootstrapping it. And I think. Ultimately, at the same time, I mean, unless you're advocating for government programs to create that, like that doesn't really connect with what most people's idea of socialism is.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. I mean, it's when I talk about the isms, I try to focus on the relationships between people within them. I think that capitalism, communism, socialism, anarchism, it all fundamentally comes down to how we relate to each other and how we handle the things that happen between us, how we exchange with each other, how we communicate with each other, so on and so on. So under capitalism, I see that as the relationship between a person who possesses capital and a person who possesses their labor. So someone who has their labor, they do not have capital, goes to someone who has the capital and trades their labor for the ability to use the capital. Under socialism, it would be a group of people coming together and they own the capital collectively and they democratically decide amongst themselves the best way to use that capital. So the person who keeps the place clean, that is necessary. The person who coordinates who does what is necessary. Like every component of a business is necessary. And if it's necessary, the person doing it should have agency in how that is to be done. There's multiple ways that cooperatives can be set up. It depends on sort of the size of it, the complexity. A small cooperative of, you know, 6 to 12 people, maybe it's a direct democracy where every single person in that company has equal say at the table. But if you have a company that, say, hires several hundred people, maybe they would democratically elect their board of executives for that company. And then those executives of the company can be recalled if they do a bad job and make everybody angry. And it sort of introduces that democracy and accountability and agency for people who are doing the work.
Right. So let me ask you this, because I know we kind of talked about this before, but and let me give an example. So let's say, for example, there was a woman who I talked to, and she was really she was leaning very far left, Democrat wise. She was higher minimum wages, free education, those sorts of things. And she worked, she had a job as a massage therapist. And we had this conversation at one point, and I said, you know, the profession that you're in, it would be very easy for you, and guilty as charged, I recommended, you know, start your own business, because that type of business is something you could start pretty inexpensively. But let's forget about the expense for a second, because that wasn't even an issue. For her, it was, I don't know how to run a business. I don't want to learn how to run a business. I just want to work for somebody. I just want to go to work, do my job. That's it. Take my money and go home. I just want to make sure that I get enough money and that the government provides some other things to me for free or at a discount. Mm-hmm. How do you feel about something like that?
So that comes down to, like, every person has their abilities. You know, everyone is able to do certain things. Everyone is willing to do one thing or another. Like, there are people who enjoy coordinating labor and helping figure out what is needed where and moving resources around. There are people who do not like that. It's not compatible with who they are. But just because one person is skilled in or compatible with one kind of labor or another, I don't think should impact the voice that they have in the direction of how things are going. Like, say, as an employee, she may have to follow certain policies that she doesn't agree with, and maybe some of her coworkers don't agree with those policies either, but they're not the decision makers, so they don't get to change that policy unless they can convince the boss. So the boss acts kind of a barrier to their ability to have agency in those policies.
So this is interesting, though, because you have, let's say, for example, as far as all of the employees, they want, you know, to take 6-hour lunch breaks, and they, you know, mm-hmm. they want to show up, they don't want to have to do the work, and they don't want to be reprimanded for that, you know, whatever that might be. And the employer is the one saying, well, hey, we need to make sure that we're delivering for the people who are bringing us this money. And if we take 5-hour lunch breaks, like, we're not going to be able to deliver. We're going to go out of business. We're going to have to close our doors. So don't you think to some degree that, and I mean, I guess it comes down to ownership, because you can have businesses that'll be formed where, you know, they'll have some sort of business ethic where they're like, yeah, no, we want our employees to take 5-hour lunch breaks. And because of that, they do poorly and they fail. But to somebody who wants to make this succeed and they need the help of other people who maybe don't agree with what's required to make that succeed, I don't know. I feel like there's some sort of friction there. And if if somebody comes into the equation and all that they want is they don't want to be a part of, they don't want to have any decision-making ability. They just know, I just want to work and get my money in return. Why should the employer have to give that up and turn into a collective, I guess? I mean, because here's the thing. Of course, it's absolutely wonderful if anybody wants to start a cooperative like that. And, you know, nobody should stop them from wanting to start a cooperative. But I mean, you wouldn't suggest that's how all businesses should operate, would you?
I'm not sure that I would, but I think that if it were easier to start cooperatives, you would see a lot more people doing it. I think that most people prefer to have that agency. Maybe not everybody does. Maybe somebody does want to have an employer. I won't tell them no. I personally do not like having an employer. But in my situation, there's very little way for me to get out of that. And a lot of people are in situations where they have employers and do not have an alternative to an employer. They could go and pick one employer or another, but at the end of the day, that's like, do you want this king or that king when you go to work?
Right.
And I think to answer your question about if everybody wants to take those long lunch breaks, you know, I think that attitude clashes with simple reality. You know, if you're just taking lunch breaks all the time and you're not working, you're not going to produce anything and you are going to fail. So that's why everyone would come together and see, okay, this much work is what is required to keep this going. So how do we divide that work up amongst ourselves and hold each other accountable to that? And if anyone decides at any point that this arrangement doesn't work, they can walk out and try something else, but this is how we're going to do it here. And it's kind of, it comes down fundamentally to how the relationships are worked out and who does what labor, who specializes in what.
Right. Yeah. And so I think, again, like from what I'm hearing, like there's absolutely nothing offensive about that. And I see people already commenting socialism never works and that sort of thing, but this isn't real socialism. But yeah, this is a completely different definition than, you know, cause you're talking about like this is just a different type of system. Mm-hmm. Of people interacting with each other. Whereas when most people say we want socialism, they want the government to come in mm-hmm. and impose it. And of course, government imposition, hopefully you agree on that, as a libertarian, you agree on that, government imposition of any system is where things just go horribly wrong.
Yeah. You know, I think that may be a good seg into my campaign as well, and sort of my approach to government. Because I do feel a tension between running for office and being a libertarian socialist. I do feel a clash between sort of entering that government decision maker role, but also feeling that there is a significant amount of government overreach. And my approach is that I am a community organizer first and a politician second. So the way that I have been organizing in my community is I find people who care about one thing or another, and I connect them with each other. And I have been working to form various single issue groups in my community. I formed a tenants advocacy association because 2/3 of the residents in Plattsburgh are tenants. So that is a group that, you know, there's a power imbalance between landlord and tenant, and it's a very structural power imbalance based on who owns the property. So in Plattsburgh, there's a situation where 1/3 of the residents own property, and 2/3 of the residents rent the property from that 1/3. So that's 2/3 of the people who are disenfranchised from ownership in the city, and maybe not everybody wants to own the property and have all of the responsibilities that come along with that. But I do think that the power relationship between a landlord and tenant is fundamentally problematic, and a better system could take care of those needs. Because your landlord tells you whether or not you can paint the house, you have to go to them for repairs. You generally cannot do it yourself. Most leases forbid that. When you pay your rent, if your landlord has a mortgage, that mortgage is usually wrapped into the rent payment. So you are effectively paying the landlord's mortgage. So say I'm a landlord and I mortgage a property and rent it out, and my tenant pays my mortgage, and then they'll move out eventually. But what I have is equity in property that was taken from another person. And yes, a contract was signed, but if you're in a city where 2/3 of the people are renters because only 1/3 of the people actually own the property, how are you going to be able to get into that property ownership?
Right. And this is one thing where, for example, I agree that ownership is way too low. Most people should own their homes. Even going back to your point about savings, saying the average person has $1,000 in savings, I don't even know if that's true, but it should be much higher.
Yeah.
When the government locked down and said, yeah, you can't go to work for 2 weeks, which turned into like, I don't even know how many weeks now. We should have been able to say, well, that's fine. We've got our savings. And as long as the essential businesses stay open and they keep delivering food, that's fine.
Yeah.
We've got plenty of savings. We don't have to pay rent because we own our homes. That would have been wonderful. And to me, like, I see the problem as, because a lot of people try to, like, you know, they come in and try to fix this with, okay, we're gonna have subsidized housing, we're going to do some sort of rent control, mm-hmm. you know, all these things that, you know, are basically trying to duct tape together the problem that was created yeah. mm-hmm. instead of going to the source of the problem and saying, okay, mm-hmm. let's get people into these homes,
yeah.
which I think is a problem created by government that would be solved mm-hmm. by getting government out of that. But of course, that's like a whole other issue that you have to solve. But in my opinion, in my belief, if we did solve those problems, we would get people into homes. And then the only people who would rent are the people who are maybe moving around a lot and mm-hmm. they don't want to buy a house. It doesn't fit their lifestyle, or, you know, yeah. they're moving to a new city. They want to rent until they find something, or they're going mm-hmm. on vacation rentals. But everyone would have like their foundation, their rock that they live on, mm-hmm. that could not be sunk by missing a month's rent or missing a month's property tax or, you know, whatever. I think it's a really difficult situation that we're in, because like you said, it's a contract and you sign the contract, but mm-hmm. I have a hard time saying like, yeah, that contract should be enforced, because I know the effects of that. I know it causes people to be homeless. It forces people into debt, all these negative things. And, you know, I know the landlords could be screwed out of that too, because they put all their money into investing with the purpose of renting. But at the same time, it's like we got to take a step back and say, look, what created the situation that these people are so desperate to sign these really terrible contracts that they're just going to be throwing away money every month? And if we solve that problem, then I think we'll all be good, because, you know, you won't have it's like an unjust leverage, right? Mm-hmm. Like, the landlords, as far as they know, I have an extra place and I want to rent it. Let's see what the market is doing. And it's like, yeah, but the market is extremely high because everybody is desperate.
Mm-hmm.
And and realistically, when we have a market where it's got like a surplus of housing in it, that like, it doesn't add up. Something's not right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, we have more empty homes than people who need homes.
Yeah.
And I think, like, I want to relate that to the situation locally in Plattsburgh. There is an organization of landlords. It's the Concerned Owners of Plattsburgh Property or something like that. I haven't checked in on them in a while, so my memory of them is fuzzy. But the one point I want to make is they're a group of about 80 people who own collectively 2,000 to 3,000 properties in the city of Plattsburgh. That much local property in the hands of those few people, I mean, that is how they make their money off owning the property. They basically, this is mine, and if anyone wants to use it, they need to pay for it. And I think actually going back to how would I differentiate between libertarian socialism and say libertarian capitalism is on the issue of public versus personal and private property. So when I would talk about the relationship between personal and private property, your personal property are the things that you use. Private property are the things that need other people's labor in order to be useful. So personal property, that's rad. Like, as long as you're using it for yourself, even if that's like a farm that you own or a machine that you own, as long as you are personally using it and you don't need to bring anybody else in. And then once you bring other people in, like say you own a business, it's your private property, you need people to come work on it for you. If you are imposing your will on those people, that is a fundamentally unequal relationship. It's tyrannical in a lot of ways, because you can be, you know, the best boss, you can be the, you know, you can give a lot of liberties to your employees, but at the end of the day, it's your decisions. You know, you hold that club behind you. And if someone doesn't go along with your decisions, you can unilaterally fire that person, and then they have to go find another employer. And that is not to say that somebody should be able to go to a workplace and do a job poorly and expect to get away with it, but I do think that there should be more accountability in that decision, that an employer should not have the unilateral power to disenfranchise somebody from being able to perform labor. That if someone is to be removed from a workplace, it should be a decision made by everyone who is doing that work. So let's go back to your friend who was at the massage place. Let's say she has a coworker who she really likes. She gets along with. The coworker does fine work, but due to a disagreement with the owner decides to fire that coworker, even though that coworker is a great massage therapist. Is that a fair situation? Or do you think that your friend, even though she doesn't want to have to manage all of the accounts and everything and be a coordinator, do you think she should have some say in whether or not that coworker stays?
Right. Well, I think it's, and I know like a lot of people will come off as, you know, there's, you can't, you know, you can't terminate somebody for a bad reason or just because you don't like them.
Unless you're in an at-will state in which you don't have to provide a reason.
Right.
You could terminate somebody over a disagreement and say, oh, they were doing their job badly.
Right. Well, and I mean, forget about what the law is, because the law is always like, you know, you can't fire somebody because of what their race, or you can't not hire someone because of their race, but you can always say, yeah. Oh, they weren't qualified. So, yeah so there's that kind of nonsense. But I think, you know, to the point of whether or not that's right, I mean, I don't see, like, anybody who runs a business, I don't see any reason like that they would get rid of somebody for no reason. Now, it might be a reason that like somebody thinks is lame, like, oh, I didn't like the way that she was cutting her hair or like something like that. But nobody who runs a business really, I mean, unless they're like total jerks, but if they're a total jerk, why do you want to work for that person? And so, but like, if it's like, oh, like I can't afford this many employees anymore. But I can't just fire you. I have to come up with a reason. Then you create this like conflict between the employer and the employee. And so there's so many different things. And even if it's just like, okay, the two of you don't get along, to some degree, it's kind of like, okay, but it's like to a lot of people who run businesses, especially small businesses, that's their home. Like their business is almost sort of their home. That's where they work. And they want to keep that as happy as they can with their friends around. It's kind of like you go to a party and you get in like even the most petty argument with the host of the party and they say, you know what? I don't like you here. Leave. You're not invited to the next party.
Yeah.
I think we kind of generally understand that. But then, of course, there's like you also have other situations where you have a manager who's it's not his business, but it's like the manager has the authority to fire somebody who's maybe not even in their department. And then, of course, you know, you can look at that and say, yeah, that's just nefarious. That's screwing around with something.
I'm starting to see a theme come up, which is like, why would people make X decision? So why would somebody work for a terrible employer? Why are so many people renting from landlords who don't maintain their properties well? Why do people work at Walmart? And I think that comes to the balance of ownership. It's because there are people who own the property and exclude others from it. It is because Walmart owns all of these stores and excludes other people structurally from getting into the game. I mean, when Walmart was first building as a company, they would come into a town and all of the small shops around the Walmart would disappear. Because Walmart created conditions that made it impossible for those smaller shops to exist. So then people couldn't go and work at a smaller shop. They had to go to work at Walmart because Walmart is what was there and Walmart had control of the situation because they had control over so many of the resources.
Right, but consider this. So Walmart comes into a town, people start shopping at Walmart instead of the small businesses because it's more efficient. But consider this, that people work for Walmart, not because they want to, but because of limited options, and I'll go as far to say as limited options because of government. But think about this, right? If you don't like your landlord and you don't want to pay rent and you don't like your employer and you don't want a job, you should be able to just go out into the middle of anywhere, the woods, the plains, wherever, and just say, this is going to be my home. I'm going to live out here. There's nature provides everything you need pretty much anywhere you go. The problem is that option has been taken away from you in two ways. One, forcefully by government, who says, oh yeah, you can go out into that field, but you still have to bring us money, which means you have to go work for someone, which might be Walmart or somebody else. You are forced to work. And that opportunity is taken away. The other one is through education, because not a lot of people know how to live like that. And that's not something they teach you in public school, because they don't want you to survive outside of the system. They teach you the only way to survive is to go work for the factory. And that's, you go all the way back to the 1920s when the Department of Education was created. And that was its purpose. We wanted factory workers, right? To fill all the factories and get, you know. And of course, when you do that, when you train everybody for the same job, what does that create? Competition. So everyone's competing for the same jobs. Well, I'll take whatever you can give me. Oh, 10 cents an hour, I'll take it. Because everybody's conditioned, this is the only way to survive. So now we're gonna have to go do this thing that we don't like, and we're extracted from our natural lives of being able to live in the outside world, in nature. But here's another thing that a lot of people will strike down about, and this is probably like the evil capitalists who will say this, is, yeah, but if everybody were able to go live on the farms, they'd all have simple lives. There wouldn't be people in factories. We wouldn't have cars and the internet and technology and all these other things. We wouldn't have all that. And it's like, okay, that's fine. We might be less motivated to work and to construct things as fast as we've come to. But what we do construct and build would be of our own free will, not of our lack of decisions. And what's even more important, like when you put this as an analogy, this is like saying to slave owners, well, hey, if we're not allowed to beat the slaves, they're not going to work as hard. And it's like, do you realize what you're saying? If you don't take people's freedom of choice away and force them to work in your factories, civilization would not be as advanced.
Yeah.
But what you're doing is uncivilized in order to get an advancement in technology, which is... technology is not a necessity of, it's a necessity of life now, because we've forgotten how to live without it, but it never was a necessity. We lived like, yeah, we live longer now, but it's like, we're still going to die. We're still not going to live forever. So I think a lot of this, like, you know, yes, it is choices and opportunities, but I think most of it is because our, you know, the kind of like the simplest of choices have been taken away from us. And it's like, imagine you go to a restaurant, right? Let me put this a different way. You go into the airport, and because airports, they're always ridiculously overpriced when you look at the restaurants and everything. And you have five restaurants to choose from. Well, the option of bringing your own food has been taken away. You can't bring your own food because of the airport security. So now when you walk in there, everything's overpriced. Same thing with the movie theater. They take away your opportunity to bring your own food, and they can charge $20 for a bucket of popcorn. And this is what our entire civilization has done when it has taken away, not to say like, oh, I never want to see a movie and eat popcorn, right? Like, it's not to say like that's the best way to watch a movie, or to say I never want to eat food again. Like, but the baseline of I'll pick my own food, or I'll grow my own food, once that's taken away, they're able to price gouge everything else. And I think that's like the ultimate low level governmental problem.
Yeah, I want to jump off of that real quick. I want to rewind a bit in time back to feudalism and kind of the origin of taxation as we know it in sort of the Western world. Was, you know, in early feudal societies, there were people who worked the land, they were peasants, so they were tied to it. and the Lord would collect their taxation in the form of in-kind goods and then use those goods to maintain an army to protect the land. As these fiefdoms became bigger and became kingdoms and sort of they expanded and became empires, moving in-kind goods became very cumbersome. Trading in hundreds of pounds of grain takes a lot of effort, but if you convert that into silver, it's easier to exchange. So that's kind of the early market economies as we know them coming into being, is these lords needed larger armies to defend larger lands and needed a way to move value in an easier way. So they sort of created a facsimile. But these communities, these farming communities where these people would live together and grow the food that they needed and make the things that they needed, they didn't care much about silver. You know, maybe they'd have a little bit of it because it's pretty, but you can't eat silver. You wouldn't want to go around wearing a shirt made of silver. So the lords, the kings had to have a way to make the farming communities, the peasants, want the silver. So they impose a tax. You have to pay us silver every year. So now these people have to produce and sell goods to the soldiers who are receiving a wage in silver from the Lord so that they can take that silver and then give it to the king. So that market exchange came out of the need for taxation. It came out of those material circumstances. There's an author, his name is Fabian Scheidler. He has a book that is soon to be translated to English. He's been doing a series of talks about it, and it's from one of those talks that I learned this bit of history of taxation. So then those conditions, that sort of early market economy, morphed into capitalism as feudalism declined. People started to exchange more and more on the market and specialize. So someone who may have had a farm and made clothing for their family and community, if they're really good at making clothing, can just make clothing. So that's kind of like a early market economy. It's post-feudal. It's not quite capitalism, but it's people starting to specialize their labor and trading in this no longer in-kind trade, but a currency is being used, the silver. So then as it turns into capitalism, especially through the Industrial Revolution, and this was when Marx was observing these developments in capitalism and the interaction with machinery, where this machinery made labor more productive. So one person just hand-tying a shirt and weaving a shirt can make many more shirts on a shirt machine. It kind of amplifies their labor. But these machines are big. They take a lot of people to make. You know, like one person isn't just going to make a shirt machine. You have to buy the parts, get the people to make it. And it would usually be these people who already have a lot of silver, who have accumulated it. Probably they were a king or a lord or whatever, and as feudalism falls away, they become these capitalists and own the means of production and start buying these machines as they're made and hiring people to make these machines that they then keep. And if somebody wants to make a shirt, they now have to go and work for this capitalist because the capitalist can undercut them on the shirt price because it takes less labor to make a shirt with the machine. And the capitalist realizes, well, hey, I can just sit here and tell all these people to use my machine, which I own, to make shirts. So that kind of comes back to that personal and private property distinction. That machine is not personal property. The capitalist is not sitting there by himself making shirts on the machine. He's bringing other people in to do it. And that is where I draw the line between personal and private property. And I would argue that private property is theft. If you have property that you are bringing other people in to work for you, and they now have a surplus value to their labor, going back to Marx's observations, because they are so much more productive, they can make 10 shirts in an hour instead of one shirt in an hour. So there's a surplus of 9 shirts. So let's say those shirts sell for $10 each. That is $100 in revenue created. The overhead on the business is $20. So we're down to 80. And then the owner decides, I'm going to pay a wage of $10 to this person, which that $10 is enough that this individual can go home and can buy the food that they need and pay their rent and sustain themselves. You know, like they can live off that $10, but the boss is still keeping 70. And then multiply that times 10 laborers. So this person is getting very rich, you know, $70 out of every worker who makes 10 shirts in a day, $700, while the workers collectively are taking home $10 each.
So I would say, I mean, yeah, it doesn't sound like a fair deal, but that was what they agreed on. The question is, why did they agree to such a bad deal? And I would say it's because, well, why didn't, if it's such a bad deal, why didn't they just turn it down?
And yeah, they
that
did.
Goes back to your,
they did.
To your original, where like, okay, yeah, but they had to get this money to pay the taxes.
Yes. Yep.
And so I guess what I'm seeing is these unfair deals are built on top of an artificial scarcity.
Yeah.
The scarcity is artificial because we have to pay just to stay alive. And I think so that's one problem on top of another problem. And I think where if we focus on the top problem of the unfair deal and say, how can we make this deal fair? Then we're not fixing the underlying problem, where if we fix the underlying problem, the unfair deal will go away.
Yeah.
All we have to do is fix the artificial scarcity.
Mm-hmm. So how do we get there?
Get rid of all the taxes.
So we eliminate the taxes. Like, the state is gone. Snap your fingers. Goodbye.
Absolutely. I mean, not completely,
I don't think, gone. We're,
there's still,
yeah. So I mean, you can't just. It's like if you have, you know, like a large object impaled into your arm, you're not just going to rip it out.
Right,
you go to the hospital and you're going to have it carefully removed, because if you just pull it, you're going to bleed out.
Absolutely.
So you want to go somewhere and have it taken care of carefully, methodologically. So that is how I think we need to approach this idea of getting rid of the state and getting rid of taxation. And I think it starts organizing locally, forming those local organizations, and then coming together as organizations and sort of from the bottom up rather than the top down. And it's sort of like, I can't tell you exactly what that is going to look like, but I can tell you that it won't look like capitalism anymore. Anyone who tells you it is going to look like this or it is going to look like that, they're either lying to you or they're lying to themselves.
Right. Nobody knows the future.
Yeah. But we can say it's not going to look like this. We don't want this. We don't want that. That, I think, is an easier claim to make, sort of these negative claims about what it might look like.
Right. And I mean, I think I agree with your point. I've actually used the analogy before of a bomb. You don't just take the bomb and throw it out the window because you might set it off. You need to surgically, you know, make sure you cut the red wire. But again, you said it's not going to look like capitalism, but what exactly do you mean by capitalism? Do you mean the unfair deals that are in place?
I mean, going back, it's the relationship, that employer-employee relationship, by the conditions of it, create those unfair deals, because a boss acting in their best interest, if they are able to keep some extra for themselves, probably will. That's just how people are. So it's about structurally changing the relationships so that people are more accountable to each other when they are working with each other. So that one person can't keep that much of another person's labor. So, I mean, without Like if there was a way for people to collectively own the t-shirt making machine, and there was a cooperative t-shirt factory, and all these people are making the shirts together and sharing the labor, I think more people would prefer that situation where they get an equitable split. You know, maybe instead of the, like there's someone, instead of a boss owning the business, there's a coordinator who looks at the overall process from that bird's eye view. But they are not the boss, they are a coordinator. So they look and they make these decisions, but that is just one role out of many equal to the role of making the shirts. So then when it comes time to divide the revenues from making those shirts, it's no longer the 20 to overhead and then 10 to the worker and 70 to the boss, now coordinator. It's split more equally, where the coordinator gets a share equivalent to everybody else who is helping to keep this t-shirt factory running.
So I think I also want to point this out, and we've talked about this before, that like, okay, so because you're talking about like profit sharing within the company, and that's always possible, because ultimately it's not even like, I mean, yeah, the CEOs usually get paid a lot, but it's like they're not taking all the profit. There's usually a bunch of shareholders who are taking the profit, and there's nothing stopping. I mean, a lot of people work for a lot of companies, and there's nothing stopping them from going and buying stock in that company. There's nothing stopping the average Walmart employee who's making minimum wage from buying a couple shares. In fact, I proposed if people wanted to do this out of protest, if they hate how Walmart is being run, if you raised a few $100 million and went out, you know, collectively with a hundred million donors, like the entire Democrat Party, came out and everybody bought one share of Walmart, they would now have a majority vote over the control of Walmart, and they'd be able to threaten the CEO and say, "Hey, either give everybody a raise or you're out of here." So that type of that's really there in some cases. Now, of course, not all corporations are public, but I think this comes down to partly education and partly desire, because there's not everybody knows that's how corporations work, or that they can buy stock like that, or that they have voting rights doing that, or maybe they just feel disempowered because of the amount of people it would take to take over a corporation like that. But some lots of corporations, more like the corporations that usually pay like salary type jobs and those types of things, offer stock options to their employees. And even then, a lot of people don't want to take those because they're not concerned about this type of dividend. They're more concerned with, I just want to get my check. I want to get my guaranteed check. And like I said, that has everything to do with incentives and desire and everything else. So I think it goes down to back to your point about it's a bad deal. Aren't there some situations where some people would say, yeah, but I like this deal? Like here's another example. Let's say there, we get rid of this, what did I call it? The artificial scarcity. We get rid of that, right? So nobody needs a job, but you have some company like Tesla, and they have amazing technology. They're doing amazing things. And there are people who are like, wow, I don't have the resources to create my own rockets like that. I want to be a part of that team. And so they do whatever they can to become a part of that team. And at some point along the way, they say, you know what? I know I don't have all the skills and knowledge that some of the other guys have. So instead of working for you for a lot, I'll work for you for a little, just so that I can say I'm on your team, because that's really what I want. And I can just walk away because I don't even really need a job, but I'm willing to take a bad deal just so that I can claim some status or earn knowledge or, anything else. That shouldn't be illegal, right?
No, I mean, people can accept whatever deals they want from what's available to them. But the devil in the details there is what is available to them.
Right.
You know, that may be the best deal they can get out of the deals available, but the way the system is set up, only a certain set of deals are available for a person to choose from. And I think that another sort of part of liberty and libertarianism is we can change those circumstances. We can change the way the system is fundamentally set up to make more deals available to people, more options available to people, better options. We can decide we want more people to be able to do this and make it happen.
But there's two ways to change that, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, fundamentally, there's two ways to change anything, either I guess fundamentally there's adding something or removing something. And if you're talking about, cause you can always add something voluntarily and nobody will complain. But when you're talking about adding government policy, which is by force, like as we started this conversation out, it's comply or die, follow my orders. It's either that way or we can say, okay, let's remove some of those orders and yep. give people more freedom and more opportunity, and they'll come mm-hmm. to these decisions on their own. I guess it's, I mean, out of those two, would you say that your ideal, what you see as progress ideally, would you see as removing government mandates or adding more government mandates?
I guess I conceive of government in a different way. I see government as more of a tool. So now who is using this tool? And which direction is the power flowing? Is the power coming from the bottom up to the government to create these quote unquote mandates? Or is it people who come together and from the top impose these mandates down upon us? I think an ideal example to dive into with this is healthcare. We are all fragile mammals who could get sick or injured pretty much at any time. We're all needing healthcare at one point or another in our lives. And it would benefit all of us, be in our best interest, to have healthcare that is freely available when and if we need it. So then how do you create that system? Because that requires multiple people to be involved. And when you need multiple people to be involved, if it's not democratic, if it's not a mutually agreeable situation, it becomes a sort of tyranny. So having that bottom up direction, and that's why I think healthcare is a good example of this, because it's sort of that ideal, everybody needs it. So everybody paying into it means that, you know, that investment is going to come back to them because they are going to need healthcare, whether it's early in their life when they get injured or ill, or if it's later in their life when their body inevitably starts to decline, because that's what human bodies do. So having that healthcare system, then what is going to manage it? And I think that kind of early on in the founding of the USA and some of these liberal ideals, we're going in the right direction, sort of having that democracy, the government by the people, for the people, you know, the slogan, no taxation without representation. So making healthcare available is going to require pooling resources. That's just fundamentally, we have to pool resources in order to accomplish this large project of providing healthcare to everybody, because we know we all need healthcare. So then how do you manage that? You know, is it going to be one person, a dictator, saying, you're all going to work and provide this to me and I'm going to create the healthcare? Or is it people collectively putting resources in and managing that democratically? So, do you understand where I'm going with that?
Yeah. So are you saying that government could collect resources mm-hmm. voluntarily from those willing to provide and organize mm-hmm. it in a way that people would be able to receive?
Yeah. And like, for example, when we pay our taxes now, a lot of them go to Raytheon or any other number of weapons manufacturers. And it's kind of echoing that early feudal system where these lords were imposing taxation in order to fund their armies. You know, they were not instituting taxes in order to pay for healthcare programs.
Right.
So sort of that taxation, if we recognize it as a tool that we can use in a democratic system, as long as we can make sure that everybody is properly represented in that decision-making process. And I think that that's sort of that phrase small government that's thrown around in conservative and a lot of right-wing circles. I kind of conceptualize that as local government. You know, it's at the local level you arrange things. But maybe this healthcare project is even bigger than the local government, and it requires multiple local governments. And well, then,
finish your thought.
So, I mean, if somebody dissents from this, for the sake of argument, because I think that's sort of like, if somebody does not consent to paying into a healthcare system, I think that would be somewhat foolish of them, because why would you not want that healthcare available, and why would you not want to do your part to make sure that is available?
Right.
Because you know that you're inevitably going to need it at some point.
Right. But to some people, see, that's the thing. Some people might say, I'm not interested in that. I mean, mm-hmm. me personally, I don't have health insurance.
Yeah.
Because one of the things that, I mean, I've seen this with my family. I've seen it with other people's family. When you start getting really old, a lot of the times what happens is, especially if you have lots of insurance, you start going through this process where you spend 10 or 20 years dying and your family is sitting around suffering for 10 or 20 years. And it's absolutely miserable. And I'm of the opinion, and I'm not saying that anybody else should be forced to adopt my lifestyle and should be forced to be left out to die, but I'm of the opinion when I start to decline like that, that I'm ready to go. I don't want to live that way, and I don't want my family to be negatively impacted in the same way that I've seen other families. So to me, that's kind of my choice. I'd rather take what I earn now, what I'm doing with my life now, and enjoy it while I can, than to, you know, save it so that I can just prolong my life and be afraid of death around every corner. But like I said, that doesn't mean anybody else shouldn't be able to do that.
And you know, I think that is a perfectly valid position to hold. Like, if you do not want to spend years of your life on convalescent care, you should not be forced to. But the healthcare industrial complex is so vast and wields so much influence over the government that they are making those healthcare decisions, not us. So they leverage their vast resources to create a situation where that is just what people do. They spend decades on convalescence, taking these meds, receiving this care, because it's very profitable for healthcare companies. Now, if somebody wants to do that, that is also valid. But the situation we have is where these companies are creating a situation where people are forced to do that oftentimes.
Right. And I completely agree with that. So let me go back to some of your points. So first of all, it sounds like, you know, you talk about a system that people would contribute to, whether it's money or resources or time and energy, that would be able to provide healthcare for people. And I see that as perfectly possible without government through some sort of nonprofit. And especially with, and we have that now, right? We have all kinds of nonprofits that are doing things like that. It's unfortunate that a lot of that there's still a lot of corruption in there. Like you have, you know, you'll have nonprofits that are raising money to cure some disease, and they're just shoveling that off to some corporations, and it's going to people's pockets. You have that. But at the same time, you also have that with government where, you know, we've had a democracy for a very long time. We've had lots of voting, and people just, they lose interest in voting. The issues become too complex. They don't understand them. They don't have time to understand them because they're so busy working.
Yeah.
And so it makes it very difficult for people to make these decisions. And so they hand it over to politicians, and that's so we constantly get screwed that way. But something that, that you said that I think is really, really important is that, okay, yes, it's unethical where if somebody's injured and you have the ability to help that person and you don't, you are withholding resources and you are forcing that person, you're not forcing that person to suffer. You didn't create that circumstance, but you have the ability. It's, I don't know, we could get into a philosophical argument about whether or not it's moral or unethical to do that, to leave them, but you're withholding resources, and that's the important thing. And when we look at the healthcare system that we have today, I think the biggest problem that we have in any aspect of it is withholding resources. I mean, I use the insulin example all the time. Insulin is manufactured in the United States for $3. It's sold in the United States for $100. Then it's exported to Mexico where it's sold for $12. And it's illegal to bring it back into the United States and sell it for $12. And why is that? They're literally withholding that resource that they know Americans need, but that they know they can afford for $100. They're going to charge as much as they possibly can. So much so that they're going to take away our right to freely travel. And I see you've got your no person is illegal sign in the back. You're taking away people's rights to travel from one place to another, to take their property, which is their money, and exchange it for a thing, and then take that thing, which is now theirs, and take it somewhere else. You're taking all these rights away from people by saying you can't import this drug, which you can't import it back into the same place where it was manufactured. It's all the government. It's all government plans, and of course, it's the corporations like these policies. They're the ones who paid the government to do that.
So that's where it comes into is like, why is that the government plan? Who is making that happen? It's the healthcare industry, because they benefit massively from that situation.
Right. And I think so one of my issues with taxes is, you know, like you said, there, like, we don't like that money going to Raytheon. But we have no control once we give it to them. Like, I mean, if we have a gun at our head saying, oh, yeah, well, give it, take it. Sorry, you got to take it. There's a gun. Whereas if at least with nonprofits and, you know, even with all the corruption there, we can say, oh, wow, it turns out this corporation is or this nonprofit is doing a terrible job, and they're taking all our money. They're stealing it. They're throwing it, whatever they're doing. And we could say, we're not going to give our money to you anymore. We're going to give it to somebody else. And especially, you know, your point about being local, because when you donate to the Red Cross, you never really know where it's going because they're so big. But if you donate to a local charity, you might see, like, oh, they're feeding the homeless today. They're doing a blood drive today. They're offering free whatever healthcare tests. Like, you can see what they're doing. You're going to be more inclined to say, I'm going to help them by donating, or even volunteer and help them raise money and do whatever else. So I absolutely think that's a great idea too.
So I think that goes back to my point that government is a tool, and it kind of depends on who is using it. Right now in this situation, healthcare companies are using the tool of government to create the situation where the medicine is exported but cannot be imported, and they have a captive market where they sell it for exorbitant prices within these borders. If we use the tool of the government for our ends, instead of the select group of people who comprise the healthcare industry, then the taxation involved in maintaining healthcare would be directed by us instead of this industry. So that's sort of where I come into it. And I mean, you propose nonprofits as an alternative to government. I'm interested, what do you see as the difference between a government entity and a nonprofit entity that would make a nonprofit preferable to a sort of government construct? You did indicate that they have some of the same pitfalls, but sort of what distinguishes a nonprofit from a government?
Right. I would say I would say mostly it's the use of force. It's with a nonprofit, you can decide, I want to do business with you. I want to help your efforts, or I don't want to. With government, you have no choice. I would also say that with nonprofits, and not necessarily, you're still going to, I mean, like you have mom and pop shops. I mean, we're talking businesses now, but you have mom and pop shops, and then you have Walmart. Walmart, because of their size, is able to do things more efficiently. At the same time, during an economic shutdown like this, Walmart's, well, I don't know. I don't want to say Walmart's going to hurt more. In some cases, I think it's going to be a bigger struggle for a bigger beast in certain situations. But so, and this kind of goes to your idea of localization or specialization, right? So let me give you an example with government. When the government was having an issue passing a budget, they threatened and did shut down the entire government. And even though they had the money, and this is one that's like TSA, right? TSA used to be its own thing. It wasn't a nonprofit, it was a business, but it was its own thing. Now, if this government shutdown had happened, all those people, they'd still be working at the same airports. They'd still be checking people for guns and knives and explosives, because that was the thing before the government said you had to have it. They'd still be doing that, but they'd be getting paid because the money wasn't going through Congress. And so when you create this kind of like this monolith, then you create a single point of failure. And if one thing goes down, everything goes down. So I guess like with the example of Walmart, if Walmart were to have its bank accounts frozen for whatever reason, how many thousands of people are going to be out of jobs? How many thousands of people are going to be able to go to the store to get their food? But if you have 100,000 little mom and pop shops that are they're not chains, they're not associated with each other, then if one of them gets their bank account frozen, or even 10% of them, you still got the other 90%. There's no single point of failure. And I think that also goes down to your point about localization too, because if one city fails in some way, it's not going to bring everything else down with it. Whereas right now we have, you know, this weird kind of connection between cities within a state and connection between states within national government. And so, you know, we have this thing, take the education system, right? When you have a federal government that says, okay, here's the curriculum. Every city in all 50 states, every child has to learn this exact same way. Well, you take out the aspect of innovation, where some teacher might say, hey, you know what? My students learn a little bit differently. I'm going to try something new with them. You take that away, and now all these kids are being forced, and that's why our education system is being failed, is because there's a one-size-fits-all or one-size-fits-none system. And so by centralizing everything like that and trying to like create one thing that fits for everybody just doesn't work. And when you have those nonprofits, you can say, well, okay, we've got two nonprofits that are trying to provide health. They're trying to provide care to the diabetics in the city. And if one is doing a much better job, they're going to get all the donors. They're going to get all the good volunteers. The other one's probably just going to disappear. And then if this one starts doing a bad job, someone else is going to say, hey, I can do a better job than that. And they're going to start up a new nonprofit. But you can't do that. Like when government's just gone bad, you can't just say, oh, well, we're going to do a better job than that government. Because as soon as you do that, then the government's going to say, you can't do that. You don't have a permit for that. We're going to shut you down.
That's interesting. So what if a nonprofit is successfully passing off counterfeit medications? Like they adulterate them somehow because it makes them cheaper to produce. This adulteration harms people, but not in a way that the average person could detect. Like it's sort of a slow incremental harm. You may want a body to oversee to make sure that those medications are not being adulterated. That is something that would be in our best interest to have this body of oversight. So then how do we create that in an equitable way? Are we going to have a nonprofit that oversees this other nonprofit? Then by what authority is that oversight occurring? By whose authority?
Absolutely. It doesn't necessarily need to be an authority. I mean, think about it. Mm-hmm. What do I have right here? I have this hard drive.
Yeah.
And on the back of it, there's 20 different logos right here. I don't even know what most of these are. But basically these are all, they're not nonprofits. This company had to pay and they send their device there and they say, review this for me. And there's organizations that do that for everything. Except where, like, why would you do that if the government already has one and they force you to do it? So with medication right now, and this is one of your, this was actually on my presidential plan and it really goes in line with your point about you don't just pull the knife out. My plan with the FDA was to actually legalize, something kind of like the Consumer Report organization or something like that, where, cause right now, first of all, it's illegal or it's worthless. If you were to create an organization that would review drugs the same way that the FDA does, it's because it means nothing because people only want to know if it's the FDA. And if it doesn't have the FDA, you can't sell it. And if it does have the FDA, you can sell it. So what do you care about the other thing? But if you get rid of that, I've seen on food in the market, I've seen non-GMO certified. And of course, that's been bastardized. And then you've got the organic certified, and that's been bastardized too, because the government gets to define what organic means, and now it's not organic anymore. But of course that's through government. But if people trust the government, which is a mistake, but if you have two stickers on something and one says, oh, this is really good, I know about this company. And then something comes out and says, oh, I heard this company is bad, I'm not going to trust their sticker anymore. Then but maybe you still trust the other sticker. That creates a way where we're actually able to pick and choose ourselves, not just let some government bureaucrats decide who's going to say, you know, this is good and this is bad, but it's going to allow us to take part in that process. So like you talk about democracy and us having a voice in this whole matter, this gives us as individuals more direct democracy, because not only do we have this review board, this certification board, to tell us whether something is good or bad, but we get to decide whether or not we like the review board. So let's say, for example, with the government, which is one big monolith, I like the FDA, but I don't like the FCC. Well, sorry, you got to take them all together. You can't say, you know, I want my, you know, what's on my TV censored by one company. It has to be censored by all by the same people. And that censorship is determined not even, you know, some way it's by by a democratic process, but at the same time that democratic process is consumed by like everybody across the entire country. So let's say, for example, people in Nevada believe that gambling should be legal. They enjoy gambling. They don't have a problem with it. Everybody there is okay with it. But if we were to democratize that to a federal law and everybody in all the other 49 states were to say, yeah, we don't like gambling, we want to make it illegal, Nevada is screwed, because now you've just overridden their right they're not bothering anybody. They're not doing their gambling in other states. And so that sort of democracy is kind of by force. Instead of each individual can say, you know, well, I'll go to the businesses that I trust that have, you know, whatever sticker on it, it might be. And it could be any. I mean, you go to restaurants and they've got the Zagat Award. They've got the Yelp reviews, like all of these things. There's so many things. And the only places these things aren't is on the things that we expect the government to do that for us. And when you look at those, when you look at doctors, not a whole lot of reviews, because we expect that to be done for us. Medications and pharmaceuticals, you can't even find out how much they cost without going to a doctor and getting a prescription and going to the pharmacy and then going through, like, I mean, try it. Go into a pharmacy and ask them how much a specific drug is, and they usually won't even talk to you unless you've got a prescription.
Yeah, actually, I'm a pharmacy technician. That's what I do for my day job. So I have people call me all the time. They're like, how much will this drug be? You actually can. It depends on if you intend to use health insurance or not, because these right. private health insurance companies vary so much in whether or not they impose a deductible, whether or not they, like, how much of the medication they cover. I have no way of knowing until I run it, because a person's health insurance policy can vary so much. Right. But let me contrast that to, we offer an employee discount, which is what the medication costs the pharmacy plus $6. Or if we have a patient who's going to pay cash for the drug, it is the cost of the drug plus $15. So that is an easy formula. I know that if they work here, I add $6. I know that if they don't, I add $15. Now that can vary depending on whether it's a $1,000 drug or a $10 drug. And that is because of the healthcare industrial complex that right. there's all these different prices. So having that simplified sort of uniform central formula for determining the cost, I can give an answer more easily. If someone calls and they're like, I don't have insurance, I have a prescription for this drug, how much is it? I can tell them because I have the information, because it's available to me, because it's collective information. I cannot tell them what it would be through their insurance, because that is private to the insurance. That is their formula, and every insurance company has a different formula.
Right.
So I think that is an argument in favor of a centralized healthcare system, because it is then uniform. It is easier to look at it. That information is freely available. And I do think that there is this tension between centralization and decentralization. Some things benefit from being centralized in certain ways, but not in others. And some things are negatively impacted by centralization, and decentralization works better.
Let me ask you this, and then I want to try an example too. And we're totally going over on the show more than an hour. But this is really,
I mean, I'm having fun.
Okay.
So
awesome. So let's keep. Yeah. We'll wrap it up, because I try not to keep the show too long, but I do want to. Yeah. So, and now I forgot what I was going to say. Going to ask you, is there a website that you can go to mm-hmm. that, you know, let's just say any given drug on the shelf that you can go mm-hmm. to that will show you a review, the certain number of stars, and people leaving their comments of how well they liked it, how well it worked, how bad the side effects were?
I am not immediately aware of anything. My recommendation to people typically is to call their pharmacy and talk to a pharmacist who has a degree in pharmacology and how medications affect the human body, and can run down the pros and cons of that medication for you. And I think that kind of comes up on, you know, how do we manage expert knowledge in a democratic situation? I mean, do you want to have to take the time to become an expert in physiology, an expert in pharmacology, an expert in economics, an expert in this and that, so on and so on? That comes back to that issue of specialization in each person being able to do the things that they are most compatible with and most enjoy doing.
Right.
So, I mean, to an extent, I would want to trust an institution to manage my healthcare, because there is knowledge that I lack. There is knowledge that I do not have the time or inclination to seek.
And that part's fine. But let me ask mm-hmm. you this. Do you trust the government as of now for that?
No, because I am not in charge of the government.
Okay.
Because the federal government is entirely out of my control, and it's controlled more by these corporations that want to profit off of me than it is controlled by me. I don't have the representation.
So wouldn't you prefer if when you go to the pharmacy, if all of those medications are FDA approved, but they're also approved by another organization, or maybe some of them are approved and some of them aren't, by another organization that you do trust, mm-hmm. and you can say, okay, I got a prescription for this. Yep. Can you tell me if this is FDA approved or if it's the other company approved? And they could tell you, mm-hmm. well, it's not FDA approved, but it is approved by the other company. Wouldn't you prefer that than then being able to go there and saying, well, we can tell you if the FDA approves it, but we can't tell you anybody else's opinion on it.
Yeah, but I don't know that that is a fundamentally different thing from a form of government. It just sounds like having multiple oversight organizations.
Well, it's just voluntary is the key to it. It's choices. It's your democratic choice of, we talk about limited options, and right now that option has been taken away from you because it's illegal. That's the simple fact to it. It's like, because we could look and say like, if that were legal, probably nobody would do it. Mm-hmm. But maybe they would, and we'll never know because until it's legal. And when it is legal, somebody might start doing it. And then we might say, hey, that's really cool. Hey, they're doing a better job.
Well, I think there are things that are very predictable because we see them happen again and again, and we observe them. Like we have seen that companies will adulterate products if they are not overseen. I mean, a notable example that I think everybody would remember from middle school is the meat companies where you would open up these tins in the 1920s and there'd be a finger in it. You know, it's what's his name wrote The Jungle about these meat companies, you know, and like back when there was child labor because you were allowed to hire children for pennies a day. Until that was stopped, you know, and that kind of comes into another conflict between this sort of letting people do things but not letting people harm other people and impose upon them.
But wasn't all the bad food government approved?
I don't know that there was an FDA at that time. I think the FDA arose out of that situation.
Interesting. Because one thing libertarians like to point out is every drug that's ever been recalled by the FDA was first approved by the FDA.
Mm-hmm.
And then of course it's recalled because it's killing people, or, you know, whatever. There's that argument too. And then, you know, I don't know. Part of this is a human experience, right? I mean, there's no way we're ever going to eliminate all risk of anything. Everything that we do is a risk in our lives. And so I think, you know, we can be smarter about our decisions. Like eating meat from a can is, and don't get me wrong, because I grew up like pre-packaged, you know, oven ready, you know, whatever, TV dinners and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Fast food, like, you know, I was totally into all that stuff. And it did take a certain amount of education for me to see, like, holy shit, where this food is coming from before I was kind of like, yeah, I can't eat that. That's disgusting. But when it's there and it's on the shelf and it's like, well, I mean, they wouldn't sell it if it was bad for you, right? That was like, that was like the mentality.
Well, people make a lot of money selling that to you.
Right. But I think at the same time, because I grew up in an era where everything was government approved, especially when it came to food. There was always an FDA and a USDA and everything else. And so I think that kind of added an extra layer of safety. Because like in my head, at least, because I would be like, oh, well, I mean, the government wouldn't just let them sell us garbage. Right. But then it turns out they're doing all kinds of crazy stuff to the food. You know, like paint, make the, or at least some sort of artificial coloring.
So I guess I would phrase it this way. Who has more access to the FDA? Who has more influence on the FDA? Is it you and me, or is it Purdue Poultry?
Right, it's definitely them.
So they're making these calls. They're using the tool of government in order to make their chicken industry more profitable. It's not you and I using the tool of government to make sure our food is safe.
Right, but if if instead of relying on government for that, we had the option to say, you know what, I don't trust government because I've trusted them before and I still got screwed.
Yeah.
I'm going to look for a different label that's on the food from a different company. I think that would, I mean, one, just that fear of, you know, a company coming out and saying like, hey, we have standards that are so much better than the FDA might kind of make the FDA shit their pants. And then a couple of you know, representatives who want to get reelected, oh, we're going to fix the FDA if you reelect me. That might actually put pressure on them to fix that. Kind of like the post office, right? I mean, the post office has a little bit of competition. It's actually illegal for FedEx and UPS and all these other guys to deliver like regular plain old letters. Fun fact, that's a monopoly. But in the package industry, like with actual packages, these other companies are, they were doing a much better job than the post office for a while. And so the post office has been pressured to live up to that. And that's a voluntary service, that, you know, you pay for when you buy stamps. So it's, I think even, and this is only a partially monopolized industry, but if you remove the, I mean, like, wouldn't you agree, that's a great word right there, monopoly. Wouldn't you agree that monopolies are bad?
Yeah, and I think that they are an emergent property of unregulated capitalism because every company wants to increase its profits, and there's only so many ways that can be accomplished. You know, a company has to pay so much for its resources. It can try to get resources cheaper. It can try to pay its employees less. You know, it can try to move these little levers and dials. But at the end of the day, increasing their share of the market increases their profits. So that incentive for a company to continually grow, to continually, you know, there's that vertical integration where they take control of the inputs and, you know, like a shirt factory will buy a cotton field so that they can more directly control the cotton, and they grow and grow and become a monopoly. So, I mean, yes, in some ways, the USPS has become an artificial monopoly. But I think that when you have an entirely unregulated market and you have these companies competing like sports teams, but instead of the losing team going home and training and having a rematch, the losing team becomes a part of the winning team. And then you keep having these matches, and every time a team loses, they become a part of the winning team. Eventually, there's only going to be one team on the field.
Right, absolutely. But I think, well, so one, so we agree monopolies are bad. So,
yes.
So I want to hammer on this point. So,
okay.
So shouldn't a, if the government is the one that holds the monopoly, even if it's just on, you know, telling you whether or not something is good for you, isn't that bad?
Sure.
So I think that's like, that's where I see the difference between a government and a nonprofit, because if this were a nonprofit, then its existence depends on it being a good job. It depends on it having a good reputation. And if there's only one, if there's only government and there's no other choice, then I think that gives them no incentive to say, hey, we got to do a good job or else people are going to go elsewhere.
I guess when I hear that, the nonprofit just looks to me like another government, a competing government.
Sure.
But it's still a sort of governing. Like it's this agency, like we were talking about, a nonprofit oversight agency is still a form of government.
And that's fine. And I've gotten into this argument with anarchists where, you know, they call me a statist because I'm like, okay, look, picture this. You have the government. It still exists.
Yep.
It still does all the things that it does.
Yeah.
It just does. It doesn't steal from anybody. It doesn't violate anybody's rights, and it doesn't hold a monopoly. Like if that was government, then that's fine. Because those are really the only things I find offensive about government. But if you remove the monopoly, then the nonprofits are going to pop up. And yeah, maybe the government is going to stick around and it's going to be one of those nonprofits. And after all, that's what, I mean, government is a nonprofit technically, right? Mm-hmm. It's just like this big, nasty conglomerated one that uses threats of violence to maintain a monopoly and to threaten people and get what it wants.
Yeah.
So if you kind of like almost neuter it to a point, you take away its ability to do those harmful things, then yeah, mm-hmm. it just becomes a nonprofit and it's not a government. And this goes all the way back to, you know, how we started this off about, you know, well, what's your definition of government? Some people say government is violence. And it's like, mm-hmm. okay, that's one definition. That might not define how everybody else defines it, but it's one definition. So I think that's the thing. Like, okay, fine. Let's forget about what we're calling it. Mm-hmm. For a minute, let's get rid of its ability to steal from people, harm people, oppress people, maintain monopolies, get rid of that. And I'll be perfectly happy with government doing whatever it wants.
Okay.
I like that. Okay.
Yeah. And I think that does come to a, you know, like that fundamental agreement we have on the direction of power, and who gets to impose will. And for what reasons and how and on who, you know, is that power coming from us and creating these common institutions, or is there an industry or a group of people that is creating an institution to impose their will upon us? I still think that fits in the framework of seeing government as a tool and sort of fitting into that, or the nonprofits would be a tool, and they are just different tools that can be employed to solve these problems of interpersonal relationships on a large scale between, you know, hundreds, thousands, millions of people that exist on this earth.
Absolutely.
You know, and like, and I come up with frictions in my own thinking, like, you know, I don't like that the government has a monopoly on the use of force and there are police that can come and demand my obedience. But then, you know, what alternative solution would there be? You know, I like the idea of militias, but then that requires everyone to be trained in being a part of a militia. You know, so that's another,
right?
You know, the more Like I want to be alienated from some things. I want to be alienated from certain decisions that I have no interest or expertise in. So I want a common institution that I can trust. And I think that's sort of what we're arguing out here, is what does that common institution look like? And I think that we're having some fuzzy definitions of government and nonprofit. I don't know how long it would take to hammer out those distinctions. It seems like we were going to wrap it up, what, 15 minutes ago?
Right.
you know, like this is all the devil in the details kind of stuff.
Right.
But, you know, like at the end of the day, you want it to be this common institution that can handle common interests in a way that doesn't require somebody to become an expert in everything. Like, I want to be an expert in the things that interest me. I don't want to have to be an expert in healthcare and engineering and civic industry and militia use of force. Like, what if I don't want to fire a gun and I have no interest in that, but there's still a possibility that a group of people would take up arms and use those arms to steal from others. And then what do we do about that? You know, what do we do about that group of 20, 50, 100, 1,000 people who come together and they're like, it's a really good deal for us to just use our weapons and take this stuff from people. So then where the people were like, we don't want you to do this. What do we do about it? How do we make sure that there is a common institution under our common control that can handle that situation without becoming something that is tyrannical upon us and sort of, you know, a double-edged sword and cutting us instead?
Right.
I don't have a perfect answer to that. Like I said, if someone tells you they know what that's going to look like, they're either lying to you or to themselves. But the process of creating that starts locally and starts in our communities, where we change the way that we relate to each other at a local level.
Right. Yeah. And I would say I agree with that. And I think the one thing that stands in my way as a obstacle to get there is the government's monopoly. So if it is some form of militia or private security, we'll never know as long as that's illegal. So I think the first thing that always needs to happen is we need to get the government out of the business of running monopolies and allow us, whether as individuals, as corporations, as businesses, as nonprofits, whatever you want to call them, allow us to do some of the things that the government does.
Yeah.
And you know, maybe we'll create something that's even better.
You know, we had that before there was a government monopoly on policing. Policing was a private institution where these private capitalists would hire security, would hire police officers, these private police officers, to solve crimes for them. What ended up happening is these police officers realized they could make deals with the criminals, and they could, you know, capture a criminal, collect the bounty, give the criminal some of the bounty, and then this person's, you know, just making a living off of that. And they instituted policing as a public service because of that problem. If you want a longer explanation of that process and sort of a deep dive into it, I want to plug Robert Evans again. He has this podcast called Behind the Police, where he studies the evolution of policing in America and a little bit internationally, but mostly focused on policing in America, where it evolved from sort of these private Pinkerton-esque firms, security firms, into a situation where these companies realized they wanted that oversight of the police because they were tired of these private police making deals with criminals. They wanted a police that was more controlled. So I find that kind of, you know, it presents a problem for that decentralized non-monopoly on force. Now, I don't like the monopoly on force, but then you look historically and there was a lack of monopoly on force. And these people with the force were making deals with the very people they were ostensibly protecting against.
So let me ask this. If, okay, I'm a person who just got robbed, and if I have the, and okay, I know that this I can hire this company who will go find the person, but there's a very good chance that they're going to rip me off and they're going to find the stuff that was stolen from me, but they're not going to bring it back to me.
Yeah.
But I also have the government. So non-monopoly, right? I also have the government, and I can go to the government and ask them to do the same.
Yeah.
What's wrong with making it illegal for the guy who's going to rip me off to do that, if as long as it's my decision? Because I'm like, yes, that's a risk. But it's also a risk that the police might say, oh, we're too busy to take care of your case this week or this month or ever. which has been a case. Like there was a case of a guy who he had like his iPad stolen, and he used the GPS thing, and he calls the police and he goes, I know exactly where it is. I just need you to go get it for me. And they're like, yeah, we don't have time for that.
Yeah.
So that's an opportunity. Or what if I have a personal relationship with the, let's just call him a bounty hunter, where I trust him and I'm not worried about him ripping me off because I, you know, we're good friends, we go way back, whatever. That I believe that should always be our choice and our decision. And I hear those things are bad, right? I mean, we do that all the time with food, right? Oh, I hear those things are bad for you. I hear that, like, that's made with, like, you know, that includes, like, rat feces in the meat. Like, I'm not going to eat that. Like, we do that all the time. We make our own decisions. And not necessarily having to be experts. But I think, you know, at the same time, we can't expect the world to be perfect. Mm-hmm. But that also means we can't expect the government to make it perfect either. But if the most offensive thing to me is just those choices being taken away.
So, I mean, and I guess that goes back to, I mean, we had that, you know, we had a situation where these private companies would decide who they trusted the most and hire out to those services. And these private capitalists got tired of being ripped off and decided, they wanted a government-run, a centralized policing institution because it worked in their favor. So
right,
they.
But at what point did they make it illegal for individuals to do that? Mm-hmm.
I don't know exactly. And like I said, it's a large topic. I mean, behind the police.
If they hadn't done that. Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. Like, it's like, okay, fine. If you want to create a new thing, that's fine. Mm-hmm. But it's like, okay, so we have one system. It doesn't work. We move to another system. That doesn't work either. Mm-hmm. Like, okay, what if we had left both of them? What if we would have had the option?
Yeah. So something new. So what does that look like? I don't know.
Right.
But I think that it is very worthwhile to figure it out and to start making decisions and coming together to solve that problem, because it is a problem and it needs our attention.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, like, sort of like, when was it illegal to have private policing, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, Behind the Police, it's 5 episodes. They're each about an hour. Like, that's 5 hours worth of material discussing this history of police and how they came about and how these changes happened. We're going to cover it in the time that we have.
Yeah. This is interesting. Is this like it's not like an ongoing podcast. It's like a mini series.
It is. So it's a subset of an ongoing podcast by Robert Evans called Behind the Bastards, where he talks about, you know, bad people, bad institutions throughout history. And he sort of goes into the history of them. If it's an individual, he'll talk about their life story, how they became the person in history that they were. So he's got this mini series within that ongoing series called Behind the Police, which he put out earlier this year, actually. It was in response to a lot of the police protests that were coming up. He wanted to do a deep dive on policing and how they came about. And I really like the style that Robert Evans uses, where he does a really good analysis of the history and the way it exists sort of in a material sense and the impacts that it has on people. He's very good at doing that kind of systemic down to granular analysis and kind of making the jump between the two and making those connections. Highly recommend that specifically, or any of his work.
Yeah, I'm checking that out right now. Mm-hmm. All right, so now that the show is almost 2 hours long.
Yeah.
No, this really has been amazing. I want to give you an opportunity just to, we've got your links to your social media in the comments, but go ahead and give yourself a plug. If anybody's listening and they're interested in what you're doing, mm-hmm. how can they help you volunteer-wise, donations, voting? Go for it.
Yeah, so I mean, I think the best way to contact me, send me a direct message on Twitter. You know, it's a very local election. Like, I don't expect somebody in Indiana to care about an election in Plattsburgh, New York. But if you want to talk about these ideas, maybe talk about how you can start having this sort of direct involvement in your own local government and what that might look like and how to get that started. My DMs are open. Like, reach out to me. I'm happy to get more people into this sort of direct involvement mentality, get more people involved in the government so that we can turn it into an institution we control instead of an institution that controls us.
Awesome. And again, everybody, I want to remind you, we came on this show as having different opinions. I think we kind of came together on some of them. We still have some different opinions on others. But we had a great conversation. We didn't start yelling insults at each other. We didn't threaten to kill anybody.
It was a good time. I had a lot of fun.
Yeah, this was awesome. And we should definitely do this again. But okay. If you're listening, I want you to take this into consideration the next time you run into somebody that has different political views than you. Even if they're a Trump supporter, even if they're a Bernie Sanders supporter, you know, however they're ideologically different from you, just take this into consideration. We're all humans. We're all just mostly trying to get by. Most of the people who support politicians that you don't like are not evil people. And even if you think the politicians are. And so, you know, just have these conversations, because what's going to happen is you're going to evolve. We're all still evolving. I'm not perfect. I don't know everything. We're all going to evolve. We're going to learn from each other. And it's really, really important. And especially because if one of us is wrong, if we never have conversations, we'll never learn from our mistakes. And we have to be open and willing to accept the fact that it's possible that we're wrong about something, as much as we all like to believe that we're always right about everything. So thank you for tuning in and listening to this podcast. This has been a really awesome show. We're not usually this long. So thanks for sticking around. And make sure to subscribe to the podcast. Share this if you're watching live on Facebook or YouTube. Make sure to share this, comment, send us your feedback, reach out, do whatever you can. And, of course, support us over at the shop at taxationistheft.cards. And until next time, I will see you, Taxation is Theft.